We kind of left off in the middle of chapter 19 of 2 Samuel, so we'll be kind of picking up there. And if you remember, we are kind of on the end, the back side of the rebellion of Absalom. And you know, after which Absalom dies, David laments. Joab, the commander of his army, says, "You don't need to do this. It's bad PR. All these people went out to fight for you, and you're crying over your son. When all these people who went out to fight for you, you should be worried about them." And so he is harshly rebuked. David changes his tune, goes out and greets the people. And then we have a situation where, David's coming back. Chapter 19, David's coming back. He had to leave Jerusalem. He crossed the Jordan. He's been over on that side. And now he has to come back into Jerusalem. And coming back, we have some interesting events that unfold. We mentioned briefly last class that when he's coming back, there is the priests in chapter 11. King David sent Zadok and Abiathar the priest, saying, "Speak to the elders of Judah, why are you the last to bring the king back to his house?" So why is it ironic that Judah would be the last people to kind of, accept David back? Those are his people, right? Those are his people. They should be pro-David group. If anybody's going to be pro-David, it should be Judah, right? It should be them, okay? So it doesn't matter. It should be them. So he's asking him, why are they the last ones? He says, "You are my brother," in verse 12. "My brother is bone of my bone. Why you should be the last one?" And it seems like there's some contention there. And so to kind of assuage some of that, he makes a change in the cabinet. What does he change in personnel here in verse 13? The commander of the army, which is no small thing, by the way. The commander of the army is a pretty big guy, power-wise. And so he takes Amasa. Amasa was the commander of the army for Absalom, right? So, this is like the other team. And so he puts him in place of Joab. And there's this change of power. And then all of a sudden, verse 14, after that happens, "Thus he turned the hearts of all the men of Judah as one man." So this seems to be the thing that clinched the hearts, was we needed to put Amasa in there as the commander of the army. And that made everything better. Everybody could play nice together in the sandbox at that point. So then that changed. So they all send return. "Return you all to your servants." And the king then returned and came as far as the Jordan. So this scene opens up, and the king and his family and his whole entourage and all his peeps are on the Jordan River, on the west side. And they need to go east into Canaan, okay? And so that's where they are at that point. And then this whole big event unfolds. It seems to be a big deal to cross the Jordan. All right? It seems to be, and you'll kind of see that as we go through chapter 19. But who's the first one to show up? This guy, Shimei, right? We'll just say Shimei, all right? Shimei shows up. Yes, that guy. Where is he in this story? We've heard of him before, right? Remember whenever David was leaving? Yeah, he was the guy that was naysaying David as he was leaving. And Abiathar's like, "Can I kill him? Please, can I kill him? Can I kill him?" Right? And David's like, "No, this cursing could have been from God. Let's just let him curse him." And so they walk all this way. The whole time, there's this guy up on this, walking beside him saying, "You silly kniggets." And so they're making fun of David, okay, in this moment. And so he comes in. Verse 16, what song is he singing now? What does the text say? He's sort of singing a different tune, right? He's saying, maybe if you please would not kill me. So verse 16, "Shimei the son of Gerai, the Benjamite, who was hurried and came down. The men of Judah met the king, and there were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him." So Benjamin, there's a lot of people Benjamin with him. "And they rushed to the Jordan before the king. They kept crossing the ford to bring the king's household." So they were helping him bring the king's household across. Remember we talked about last time, that this is an event to cross a river. It's not just, you know, let's get in the canoe. There is quite a process in doing this. And he says in verse 19, so he said to the king, let not my lord consider me guilty, nor remember what your servant did wrong on the day when my lord king came from Jerusalem, so that the king would take it to heart. For my servant knows that I have sinned. The servant knows. Now, what's interesting about the words that he chose to use, don't remember my sins anymore. I have sinned. It's interesting. Has David ever been in that same situation? Not the same kind of sin, but has David been in that position to be asking of God the same kind of thing? Definitely, right? Definitely. So do you think David may be remembering where he's been? Pardons this guy. He says, therefore, behold, I've come today, the first of all the house of Joseph, to go down to meet my lord, my king. But Abishai, now Abishai is a commander in the army as well. He's not the commander, but he's commanded a third of the army in other cases. He's a pretty tough guy, one of the mighty men. And what does he say? Abishai was a guy before who wanted to kill him, and now what is he saying? He still wants to kill him. He still wants to kill him, right? Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said, Should Shimei be put to death for this? Because he cursed the Lord's anointed. Which is a button for David, right? That's a button for David. You don't do anything against the Lord's anointed. He's killed people for that, right? And so maybe Abishai is saying, well, I'm going to push this button on David, and maybe I get to kill him now. And what does David say? What is David's response? Do we need to keep killing each other? Basically, in a nutshell, is what he's saying. He's saying, really? Really? Do we need to keep killing each other? Is what he's saying. And he says, the king, you shall not die. Thus the king swore to him. However, if you want to write out here, 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 8 through 9, David warns Solomon about this guy, and there's some repercussions that come to him later on. So if you want to just write out there, this is sort of a preamble. This is a foreshadowing of events to come concerning this guy. So if you want to write out there, 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 8 and 9, and then verses 36 through 46 kind of talk about his fate. That's again 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 8 and 9. So he is warned. All right, so that's Shimei. And then Mephibosheth comes in. Now remember who Mephibosheth is? All right, son of Saul, grandson of Saul, you know, and he's crippled, right? Because his nanny fell on him. And he comes to David. Now when David leaves Jerusalem, what happened concerning Mephibosheth? Do you remember what happened when he's leaving Jerusalem? Yeah, his servant came out. The servant of Mephibosheth came out and said, "Hey, Mephibosheth, it's hard to say that name fast. Is going to be on the team of Absalom. He's team Absalom, and I'm faithful to you, and I've come out to you, and I brought you know these camels and these figs and stuff for your travel, and kind of butters up David and lies concerning Mephibosheth. Okay, and no, so Mephibosheth is here." And so he comes out, and so he apparently was in a state of mourning while David was gone, didn't even care for himself, didn't do anything, didn't even care for his feet that were crippled. And so he, until the king departed and came home. And it was this time in verse 25, it was when he came from Jerusalem to meet the king that he said to him, "Why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth?" So David's asking, "Hey, why didn't you come with me?" And so he answers, "Oh, my lord the king, my servant deceived me. For your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself that I may ride, because your servant is lame." Obviously, you know, don't forget that I can't walk. "Moreover, he slandered your servant to my lord and king." So he knows what took place. He understands what went on. And so he says, "I was nothing in my father's house of dead men. I was nothing, and so I can't complain about anything." And so David then says, why do you speak about your house? And he says, you and Ziba will divide the land. And Mephibosheth, seemingly in a state of graciousness, says to the king, let him even take all of it, since my lord the king has come safely to his own house. Let him keep it. Let him keep all of it, since you've come. Showing his solidarity, a sign that he is not there to cause problems. And, you know, he gets to eat at the king's table anyway. So there may be that situation going on. So that's a good nature on behalf of Mephibosheth. Now we have another guy coming. And so as we are at the Jordan and these people are crossing the Jordan, these people are coming to David. And it's a big event, as we're seeing here. It's a big event, David coming back into the land. And now Barzillai, the Gileadite, comes in. Now, we remember him, of course. You remember that guy, right? You remember all these strange little names. Chapter 17, verses 27 through 29, when David, they were fleeing, and they came to the city that they ended up being their stronghold. This guy came and brought them beds, they brought them food, took care of all the people who were traveling with David. He was a mighty man of that era, or a gracious man, a wealthy man, who took care of King David and took care of David's family while they were on the lam of sorts. And so this is that guy. And so he comes to greet David. He comes down from his town and to escort him over the Jordan. All right. So again, everybody's coming out of the woodwork to escort David back over the river Jordan. This is almost symbolically like he's returning to Israel. I don't know exactly all the symbolism in relationship to the details about why this is such a big deal, but David is coming back, and everybody wants to be a part of that. And so here is this. And in verse 32, it says, now Barzillai was very old, being 80 years old, and he said, and he had sustained the king while they had stayed Manahem, and he was a very great man. And the king said to Barzillai, you cross over with me, and I will sustain you in Jerusalem with me. Now listen to how he responds. But Barzillai said to the king, how long have I yet to live, that I should go up with the king to Jerusalem? I am now 80 years old. Can I distinguish between good and bad? Or can your servant taste what I eat or what I drink? Or can I hear any more the voice of singing men or singing women? I can't even tell if it's men or women singing at this point. Why would I want to go and enjoy the pleasures of being in the king's court? Does it sound like he's complaining? Maybe. Is he complaining about his age? Or just stating the fact that he's stating the fact. It will not be beneficial for me to go over there. Listen, and we see that even more as we read on. He says, why then should I go? Should your servant be an added burden to the Lord, the king? Your servant would merely cross over the Jordan with the king. Why should the king compensate me with this reward? So again, this idea that crossing the Jordan with the king, being there with him, is a reward, a symbol of something. Please let your servant return, that I may die in my own city near the grave of my fathers and my mother. However, here is your servant. So he just wants to go home, finish his days in peace, and die in his own house. That's what he wants, right? He's lived his years. None of that's going to benefit me. He says, it's not going to benefit you, David. But what he does is he looks out for future generations. He says, however, here is your servant, Chimham. Let him cross over with the Lord my king and do for him what is good in your sight. And so this is his son. And then David says, yes, I'll take him over, and I'll do what's good in his sight. In verse 39, all the people crossed over the Jordan, and the king crossed too, and the king then kissed Barzillai and blessed him and returned to his place. Now, it's interesting that in 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 7, David says to Solomon to take care of the sons of Barzillai. Take care of them. David's one who remembers favors. He remembers those who are good for him. He remembers the deeds of the righteous. Also, if you want to write out there, Psalm chapter 92, verses 12 through 14, let's look over at that psalm real quickly. I can find it quickly. Psalm 92, verses 12 through 14. The righteous man will flourish like the palm tree. He will grow like a cedar in Lebanon. Planted in the house of the Lord, they will flourish in the courts of our God. They will still yield fruit in old age, and they shall be full of sap and very green. And so here is this kind of concept that can good be done at an old age? Yes, good can be done at an old age. How old was Moses when he started leading the people in the... 80 years old. The man was 80 years old. Now, apparently, the 80 years old during the time of Moses is not the same 80 years old during the time of David. There's, you know, maybe some things have changed. Life expectancy or whatever has changed, but he was an old man. Joshua himself was battling until the ripe old age of 110. So, you know, there are still good to be done. And in this case, he talks about his life and what he's done. He talks about where he wants to be at the end of his life, and he looks out for the future. This righteous man, when you look at what he's done, David considers him to be a good man and taking care of the future as well. And he was a blessing to David and a blessing to those around him as he took care of David and took care of his family when he was on the run from Absalom. So again, a great example here. This man and David thought very highly of him, as he is one of the ones that are mentioned in this period of crossing the Jordan. Now they've crossed the Jordan in verse 40, and the king went up to Gilgal, and Chimham went with him, and all the people of Judah, also half the people of Israel, accompanied the king. Now here again we have sort of an issue between Israel and between Judah. And behold, all the men of Israel came to the king and said to the king, "Why had our brothers, the men of Judah, stolen you away and brought the king and his household and all of David's men with him over the Jordan?" Then all the men of Judah answered the men of Israel, "Because the king is a close relative to us." Of course. Right. So here is, what are we fighting over at this point? What are we fighting over? Family rights. Who got to be close to David, right, in the crossing of the Jordan? Israel feels kind of left out in that story, and they're complaining about that. And they go on to say, "Why then are you so angry about this matter?" Is what Judah says to Israel. And he says, "We haven't eaten from the king's expense. We've not taken anything from him." But then the men of Israel, in verse 43, answered the men of Judah, "We have 10 parts to the king. Therefore, we also have more claim to David than you do." So what are we talking about? We're talking about the 10 northern tribes saying to Judah and Levi, essentially, that, you know, we have more right to David than you do. And so there's this, rah, 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 we like him more. No, we like. And so they're fighting over David, being around David in this crossing, perhaps winning favor, perhaps showing their solidarity. It's interesting that Judah fights so strongly for this when they were the ones who were kind of dragging their feet on even bringing David back. So it seems sort of weird in that sense. So they have these 10 parts of a claim. "Also, we have more claim on David than you. Why then did you treat us with contempt? Was it not our advice first to bring him back to as our king? Yet the lords of the men of Judah were harsher than the words of the men of Israel." So here are just kind of how that ends. Now, there's that in the background, this going back and forth between Judah and Israel. When Jeroboam and Rehoboam come onto the scene, have you ever wondered, why do they split that way? Why didn't they kind of do it evensies, like 6-6? You know, there's 12, right? Why did they split this 2-10 split? Here's part of it. There's this backstory of this strife between the two for a while. And so seemingly when Jeroboam comes on the scene, he kind of sows that discord and brings this kind of stuff back up as far as that's concerned. So we have that in the background whenever we do get to Jeroboam and Rehoboam in the future many years from these pages in 2 Samuel. Now, David's coming back in. He's listening to the yah-yah between Judah and Israel. And then what happens? Peaceful entry. All is good. Nothing is wrong. How does chapter 20 open up? A worthless fellow and another rebellion. Another rebellion. Seriously? It's like God cursed him or something, right? So, and so we have this worthless fellow, as is described here. Not a description. If you were in the Bible, would you want that description? No. Tombstone. Here lies worthless fellow. Nobody wants that. But here is the Sheba, the son of Bichri, and so he blows the horn, and we have no portion with David, nor we have any inheritance with the sons of Jesse. Every man to his tent, so Israel, and so Israel flees. You know, seemingly, you know, like the allegiance of Israel is at the, you know, just a very, very thin, the allegiance of those tribes. Yes, sir.
Over in 1 Kings 10. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Is this the same Sheba that she's from?
No. This is a guy's name. That was a region that she was from. And this is a very good question, and it actually made me think of that whenever I read this guy's name. But this is actually an individual's name, and she's from a certain region. But a very, very good question as far as the king of Sheba or queen of Sheba and this guy here. And actually that reminded me. Never mind. Forget that. Random thought. But as we look at this instance, so here they are, and they go off. And so all the men of Israel withdraw from following David and followed Sheba, the son of Bichri. And so that would be rather bothersome, wouldn't it? Not again. So David comes to the house at Jerusalem, and you know immediately when he gets there, he takes the 10 concubines who had stayed behind, who had been taken by Absalom. He takes them and basically puts them away, seemingly under sort of kind of a seclusion. Takes care of them, but he never really comes back to them. And it says in verse 3, at the end of verse 3, that they were shut up until the day of their death, living as widows. Essentially, that David really never came to them again. And then, so because of this rebellion, verse 4, Amasa is called because he's what? The commander of the army. You call Amasa when you need armed forces. And so Amasa comes in and call out the men of Judah for me within 3 days, and be present here yourself. So he's been given a duty to do what in 3 days? Show up. Have all the army ready. We're going to go after this guy. That's what he's been told to do. What happens? In verse 5. So he goes out, but what? He didn't do it in 3 days. You know, he's new. First down the jab, and he's got a rebellion to deal with. So Amasa went out to call the men of Judah, but he delayed longer than the set time which David had appointed him. And David said to Abishai, "Now Sheba the son of Bichri will do more harm than Absalom." Because the issue here is you want to get on this as soon as possible for two reasons. One, he's going to be gathering more support and gathering a rebellion against David. Second, he's going to be finding a fortified place to hole up in, and it's going to be harder to ferret him out of that situation. And it's going to cost more lives. It's going to just be more costly a situation. And he says this is going to be worse than dealing with Absalom because we've delayed in going after this guy. And so what does he do in that delay? In verse 7, so who does he do? Who does he talk to?
Joab.
Joab. You got to take care of this. So Joab's men went out after him, along with the Cherethites and the Pelethites. Now these guys are sort of like mercenaries of sorts, guys who had been with David for a while. They've possibly come from Gath and other areas. Are not necessarily, we're not talking about Israelites, but men who are serving David. and they are loyal to David, and they go out. And so these guys go out. These are basically his elite squad, and his mighty men go out after this guy. I don't know if you've ever run from anybody before, but I would run from these guys, okay? And we'll see why later on. But these guys are bad dudes, and they're going after Sheba. And so they go out from Jerusalem to pursue him and go after him. And then here we have this situation. And when they were at a large stone, which is in Gibeon, Amasa came to meet them there. So this large stone, don't know what it is. It's a large stone. We don't have any indication. It's just a landmark, perhaps. Meet me at such and such time by the big rock. That's basically how you meet. You know, they don't have GPS, and so that's how you meet up, by the big rock. When they get there, now Joab was dressed in his military attire, which you'd expect of Joab, right? You're going out after a guy, you're going to be dressed in your military. So he had his fatigues on, and he had his belt with a sword in its sheath and fastened at the waist. Now, here's a guy who is commander of an army, has been for a while, fighting with David's mighty men. Do you think he knows how to handle a sword? Probably. Do you think it's an accident in this moment that the sword falls out? What happens? What happens here? So Massa strolls up, right? And he says, "Is it well with you, my brother?" Which, by the way, they're cousins. Just so you know, they are related. They are cousins. And so Joab took Amasa by the beard, his right hand, to kiss him. Kissing cousins, apparently. Now, it's a greeting. They did that back then. Guys could kiss. It was all right. And so that was, grabs him, you know, because they have beards. It's biblical. All right? So they had beards. But what does verse 10 say concerning Amasa? He was not on guard. Now, would he need to be on guard? This would not be a situation. His situational awareness radar was low, right? He's in the camp, so to speak. He's amongst friends, quote unquote. He's here with his cuz. You know, his guard is down, all right? But Amasa was not on guard against the sword which was in Joab's hand. So it was not an accident that the sword just slipped out. This was a plan. So he kind of does one of these things, right? And has that sword ready. And what does he do with it? He doesn't kill him. He guts the guy. Now, I'm sure you guys have not studied what happens when you disembowel somebody. I don't think you've Googled that. I took it upon myself to do that for you. But when you disembowel somebody, for one, it hurts, right? I mean, it hurts. But you don't die right away. You don't. Look at the story as we see here. And so it says, he stuck him in the belly with it and poured out his inward parts on the ground. And so they just kind of billowed out. If you've broken that lining and everything, it just kind of just came out, all right? Like a bantha or whatever. So you just they came out on the ground. And Joab and Abishai's brother, so they went on pursuing them. Now, what's happening here is this. We read ahead in verse 10, and it looks like they just, you know, got the guy and leave. But what happens is, so that's like the full story, and then we back up in verse 11, and there stood by him one of Joab's young men and said, "Whoever favors Joab and whoever is for David, let him follow Joab." And so these events happen before they actually go after and chase down this guy Sheba, okay? And so when the man saw that all the people stood still, so here is Joab greeting his cousin, guts him, and disembowels him, and you're like, huh? Okay, so this just happened. And so it seemingly kind of pauses everybody around, fixated around this moment, which, you know, as the text says, it says that that he saw that all the people stood still. So he removed Amasa from the highway into the field and withdrew the garment. So when he strikes him down, he's basically wallowing in his own blood where he got struck down. And everybody's kind of watching this. And nobody's moving. And so the guy's like, all right. So he just drags this guy off into the bushes and covers. It never happened. It never happened. We can go to war now. Okay, so that's basically what happens in this story. And they go on. All right, they go on. And so now there's this takeover. Yes, sir? Well, that's why this young man's saying, hey, be for Joab, right? If you're with Joab, you're with David. Right, so he's trying to call them out. Let's go, guys. You know, hands in, go team on three. It's kind of what he's trying to do with these people to get them going. But there's this guy in the road, you know, kind of entangled in his own entrails, and we can't get over that. We cannot get over that fact that that's happening. And so they finally do that. Now, as they go on, he's removed from the highway, and they all pass. And they go to the tribes. And so they go all over the place, verse 14, trying to find where he went. Where did he go? Where did he go? And they came and besieged him at Ebal. And they cast up a siege ramp against the city. And it stood by the rampart. And all the people who were with Joab were wreaking destruction in order to topple the wall. Okay, so you got to go topple a wall. The Romans did this in Masada. Basically, you make an earthen ramp, and you just start toppling the wall to get in, to break into this fortified city. Wisdom strikes an individual. What does it say in verse 16? Then a wise... Okay, men have fought against each other, and wise women have stepped in with counsel. In this case, another example where this happens, a wise woman called from the city, "Hear, hear, please, Joab, come here, that I may speak with you," she says in verse 16. So he approached her, probably rather cautiously, because Bible women have killed people before. So he approaches her, and so what does she begin to say? He said, "Are you Joab?" And he answered, "I am." Who's asking? Then she said, "Listen to the words of your maidservant." And he answered, "I am." And he said, then she spoke, saying, "For merely, they used to say they will surely ask advice at Abel." And so apparently there's this saying about asking advice at this city. And so she's calling up an old colloquialism about the city, and she says, "And thus they ended the dispute." So basically saying, we can work through this, okay? I said, "I am those who are peaceable and faithful to Israel, in Israel. You are seeking to destroy a city, even a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the inheritance of the Lord?" What she's saying is, why are you going to attack us? Look, we're on your side. We're on God's side. Why are you going to attack us? Why are you wanting to destroy the city? Why are you coming at us? Why are you hating on us? Would be the how you would say it nowadays. But Joab says, far be it from me that I should swallow up and destroy. Such is not the case. But a man from the hill country of Ephraim, Sheba, the son of Bichri by name, has lifted up his hand against King David. Only hand him over, and I will depart from your city. And the woman said, "Behold, his head will be thrown to you over the wall." Which I find interesting. It does not say that she turned around and said, "Hey, what are you going to do about this?" It doesn't say that she turned around and convened with everybody and said, "Hey, do we want to, you know, are we, yeah, okay." It doesn't say she did that. What does the text tell us that she did? Yes, his head will be coming over shortly. Stand back. Is basically what she says, which is interesting that she takes it upon herself to do that. And that is exactly what's happened. And so they behold, his head will be thrown over you over the wall. The woman wisely came to all the people, and they cut off the head of Sheba, and they threw it over the wall. And Joab also returned to the king of Jerusalem. And so everybody went home happy. All right? That's interesting. I find that interesting. As you read these events, the narrative of times gone by is interesting how they unfold. Now he goes back, Joab, over the whole army of Israel. And now we have in verses 23 through the end of the chapter, this sort of the cabinet of David, those who are important to David in that time. Joab was over the whole army of Israel. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was over the Sherethites and Perethites, basically the band of mercenaries. Adoram was over the forced labor. Jehoshaphat, the son of Ehud, was the recorder, not the king. Jehoshaphat, we'd see later on. And Sheva was the scribe, and Zadok and Abathar were the priests, and Ira the Jarite was also a priest to David. So here we close out chapter 20 in that order. The revolts are over, that's done, and then we get into some good old-fashioned revenge in chapter 21. So I need to advance the slide a bit. Chapter 21, opens up with a famine, which is always fun. There was a famine in the days of David, and the Lord said, David asked why. He says, it's for Saul in verse 1. It is for Saul and his bloody house because he put the Gibeonites to death. Now, who are the Gibeonites? Chapter 21 opens up with this mention of these people. We've kind of mentioned them before, but who are these people? Do you remember? They are shady. They're tricksters, these guys. So when the people come into the land of Canaan and they're toppling and they're destroying and everybody's shaking their boots about these people of Israel, they've come in to take over the land of Canaan. So you have some options, right? Most people went out to fight them, and the kings would come together and go fight against the Israelites, and died. They died. The Gibeonites decided, let's do something different. We're going to be friends. We're going to make nice. But not just that, they made it look like they were wandering in too. They had old bread, they had old wineskins, old clothes. They made it look like they've been traveling for a long time. And they said, hey, we're coming into this place too. We're new here. We're the new kids on the block as well. They basically make an accord with them. And this is in Joshua chapter 9, specifically verses 19 and 20. They make an accord with them that, hey, we're not going to kill you guys. You're new here too. Later on they find out, and the text actually says, without asking God, later on they find out, oh, they're from this area. They tricked us, but we had already made an oath. And so they ended up making them basically bondservants. They are the ones that went and got the firewood. They're the ones that got the water. And they became that kind of servitude to the people of Israel. They couldn't kill them, but apparently Saul did that in his... Saul does this. And so they've made a covenant with him. And we're given in chapter 2, verse 2, sort of a kind of a historical background about all those events. And so David says to them in verse 3, what shall I do for you? And how can I make atonement that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord? So what do the Gibeonites say? Do they want silver and gold? Do they want to kill everybody in Jerusalem? What do they want to do? We got 5 minutes. Was that the second bell? Are you kidding me? All right, that is not how far I wanted to get tonight. Yeah, they're going to want to kill Saul, so we'll just leave it there. Cliffhanger. We'll have to leave it there tonight. Thank you very much for your comment and your time tonight.